Hello, everyone. Welcome to the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is still in the yellow zone out of this recording, if you know what that means, because we're still in quarantine, but I'm still doing this podcast and talking to really interesting people from across the country who, like me, decided to run for office for one reason or another. If you've been listening to the podcast, and I hope you have in the past, we've talked to people from Pennsylvania, to New York, to Maine, to Florida, to Alaska, and almost everywhere in between. And I've had a goal of talking to someone in every state that's really cool. And today, I finally have my first guest from West Virginia. Her name is Rosemary Ketchum. And we're going to talk about her recent election, what she's doing in Wheeling, West Virginia, and making some history along the way. So please subscribe, send me your emails or comments if you're interested in someone else or have some things you want to ask later. And here we go. Rosemary, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking myself. Thank you for taking time today to talk on my podcast.
Hey, Tony. Thank you so much for having me on.
You have had a very busy week, huh?
This is true.
So you just won an election in Wheeling, West Virginia. Tell me about what you won. Tell me about what election you ran for.
Yeah, so I ran for Wheeling City Council. We're a town of less than 30,000 people. I decided to run about a year ago for my third ward seat, which encompasses about four neighborhoods, rather.
Well, just so you know, I am also a third ward council member, so I'm liking you even more. So, and Wheeling, I was interested in talking with you for a number of reasons that we'll get into, but my mom's family had a connection to Wheeling, West Virginia with a Bedway coal and had a house down there. I haven't been to Wheeling in 30 years. So what's Wheeling like these days? Because I'm reading your issues, and obviously the reasons you ran reflect the state of Wheeling today.
Yeah, so Wheeling is small but mighty. Our our city name is the Friendly City, and I feel like we try to exemplify that in as many ways as possible here in the city of Wheeling. Like so many towns throughout Ohio and West Virginia and the kind of this area, our history is in manufacturing, and it looks like our future won't be.
Right.
So much of our economy has been hit throughout the past few decades with plants leaving and manufacturing kind of disappearing throughout the tri-state area, and our little community here was hit particularly hard. So throughout the past few decades, we've had some economic revitalization here in the city of Wheeling. The pace, feels glacial, as it does for, anybody in a town that's, trying to get ahead. But we're doing some really, really good things here to put ourselves into the 21st century.
So West Virginia nationally has a bit of a reputation, right? It's people, fortunately or unfortunately, look at it, and I guess every city has a reputation. I talked with Rigel Robinson from Berkeley, California, and let's just say their reputation is different from West Virginia's reputation. But you made history this week, and a big reason why people are talking to you is you're the first transgender candidate to win in West Virginia, right?
Yeah, the first open transgender candidate.
Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, congratulations. It's really exciting news to see that progress can be made in West Virginia. That must feel very meaningful to you and your supporters, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't run for office to make history. You run for office to make a difference in your community, and I guess we made history along the way, which is really awesome. It's so funny talking about stigma. I work in mental health, and I talk about stigma every single day with my clients, and West Virginia has a particularly concerning issue with that. I have had experiences where I, travel out of the state for conferences, and when people learn I'm from West Virginia, they kind of look at me and go, "Well, what's that like?" And I say it's, I guess, like any place else. a little more unique, perhaps. But yeah, I think that's one of our biggest obstacles here in the state, is overcoming what people believe about us. And that's not easy.
And I know one of your issues that you talked about in your campaign, and I think that you've been talking about since before you decided to campaign, is retaining young people in the city and even bringing them back there, right?
Yeah, no, it's incredibly important. I'll be the youngest person on our council, and maybe one of the youngest elected officials here, in our valley, which, I'm 26, so I'm not too fresh, but we have a really difficult time retaining young folks, young ideas, and that kind of energy. So, and the irony is, actually, we have, I believe, we have more colleges and universities in our area than any place else in the state, and yet we still have a particularly tough time, keeping young folks here. So that's definitely one of the reasons I ran for office here in the city, so that I could, hopefully, influence that change.
And I wasn't just asking to jump from one topic to another. I think that,
right.
In my county and in a lot of places in Pennsylvania, we've been passing non-discrimination ordinances. And part of it has been because businesses and young people both want to be in an open and friendly and welcoming environment. And I would assume that maybe part of your hope is that when people see you making this big impression, they will change their perception of West Virginia, and the younger people will see it as a place that they shouldn't discount as a place to live and work.
Right, and I really do believe part of that conversation is shifting the framing around what we think young people want.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that you moved to a city so that you could get a job in that space. And now we know that the jobs are more remote than ever,
right.
Especially with COVID. We don't have to, work in a space with other people as often as we once did. I think younger folks move to an area because of the culture. They move there because they can see themselves growing and thriving and meeting awesome people. And that's harder to, in some ways, effectuate than, bringing jobs to a community, changing the culture. But I think that is some of the most important work that any city can do in the country.
And a few weeks ago, I talked to Brianna Titone, who is the first transgender person to win a race in Colorado. And she's wonderful. And she has this amazing science background that really put me to shame when I was reading it. Like, I've read some books. And so I think but in learning about her and learning about you, you have this really cool background that's breaking barriers, but you don't want that to be your own story, your only story, right? Like, you don't want people to only make news about that. You would like to, if they're talking to you, to be able to highlight these things that you've been working on, especially young people, mental health, homelessness, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I had a lot of fun canvassing our city. I started a little early. I started canvassing in January for our May primary. Thank God I did do that, because once March 15th hit, we couldn't knock on any doors because of
right.
COVID. But, I had conversations with folks that were incredibly diverse and deep. And folks, if they knew I was trans, they didn't bring it up, it wasn't part, I believe it wasn't part of that decision-making process. It was, can we trust this person? Does this person know our community? And, is this person willing to work on the ground at a grassroots level? My kind of origin story is in community organizing. When I was younger, I would organize protests and lobby and advocate, and I still do that, and it's what I really do love, and I think it prepared me. I think it's a really good kind of jumping off point for elected office, because it's the most grassroots kind of on the ground experience you can have, and I think that really set me up well to run for office.
Yeah, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and one thing, it's for everybody. when they're a candidate, for especially if they haven't done the work you have, the hardest part sometimes is just talking to strangers for the first time, right?
And correct.
It's a little bit easier when you've done it in some capacity beforehand.
Yeah, no, so many of the volunteers and folks, you know, who were interested in helping the campaign, they said, I'll do anything, but I do not want to canvass.
Right.
I do not want to door knock. And I'm lucky because that is like my favorite thing to do. So, that was, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, when I would be on a campaign and volunteers would come in and say, I will definitely stuff envelopes. Like, we don't have envelopes and stuff. We have...
Yeah, 2020.
Right. what do you want to do?
Right.
I'll answer phones. Like, no one calls here.
Right.
But one thing, and, you know, you talk about stigma, not just about West Virginia or Berkeley, like I mentioned, because mm-hmm. people can have a stigma either way, but you have been working on stigma in terms of mental health in your professional career, right? And that's something obviously is very important.
Yeah, for sure. I've been, I'm the associate director of a mental health facility here in the city of Wheeling. And, you know, I went to school for psychology because I loved thinking about, you know, the human experience and, you know, kind of diving into, you know, the questions about what we do and why we do it. And stigma has been this kind of constant, resonant concept in mental health and in my, you know, experience as a trans person and just living in West Virginia, the kind of layers of, mm-hmm. of stigma there. And so in kind of the realm of mental health, we know that opioid addiction and homelessness and so many of the other things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, not just here in the city of Wheeling, but across the state of West Virginia, at base, those are mental health issues. You know, those are issues that people have oftentimes because of unresolved, you know, mental illness or mental health. So it is kind of a lifelong struggle to advocate for, you know, improved and enhanced mental health resources because, you know, elected officials unfortunately do not prioritize mental health in the way they should. Especially on a state or federal level. And, you know, I think so many of the kind of issues that we deal with today are a result of kind of unacknowledged trauma and, you know, mental health issues. So stigma is a really, really important part of that.
And, you know, you mentioned trauma issues. Right now, like you said, your campaign gets upended because of COVID, as everyone's mm-hmm. life has. This is a traumatic time still, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. Do you think that changes the discussion about mental health because everyone's dealing with this?
For sure. It's so rare. I you know, this you know, time in history is fascinating to me. And I really like to look at a kind of big picture thing.
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to do now is there will be a pre-COVID world and a post-COVID world. And, you know, those of us who lived in the in-between, which is right what we're dealing with now, it's the in-between, we will have, you know, I think residual, you know, mental health issues as a result. Not maybe, you know, for some of us, incredibly traumatic, for some less so. But it's going to be there, you know, similar to what, you know, the nation experienced in 2001 with the, you know, attacks on the Twin Towers. It was a national time of grieving. And, you know, it is particularly interesting now with COVID that we are having a global collective experience. And that doesn't happen. Like, I cannot really think of a time that we had a global, everyone is on the same page kind of thing. And unfortunately, we're not really on the same page in regards to how we treat or handle these issues or even the information that we have. So I think, again, this is a very layered conversation about, you know, not only the personal kind of traumas that we're experiencing, especially folks who are losing their jobs and losing their loved ones, literally, who are dying as a result of this virus, but also the kind of reverberating motion that this will have on history and how we just do our work. This will definitely be kind of case study for the next century, at least.
Yeah, you know, I feel like there is a divide in the understanding of it between people who are, I don't know what the age range is, but it seems like people who are younger seem to understand that in a way where maybe people who are older, and I don't mean senior citizens, like,
right,
just people who are older are like, yeah, we'll get through it and we'll get back. And then younger people like yourself realize, like, no, we don't go back. Like, there is, like you were saying, do you see a divide in terms of people's thinking about what the next years will be?
Yeah, I definitely see the divide in comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
And not in just in intelligence, because, you know, before, you know, I thought intelligence was linked to comprehension. I thought, you know, if you believed this, then this was kind of your level of intelligence. That's not always true. But, you know, I think what we are dealing with now is really issues about comprehension and about, you know, the kind of level that we are experiencing this at. Scale is what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel pretty capable of understanding the scale, even though it's so broad. But there are people in my friend group, most, I'll say, are older than me, maybe in their 40s or 50s or 60s, who not only, I think, underestimate the scale of what we're dealing with, but aren't always able to comprehend what that means.
Right.
And so just in the language that's being used around this, like you said, like, it's not that big of a deal. It's just like the flu, you know, get over it. Kind of this disregard for the anxiety around it. And I understand it's also, you know, we could say a defense mechanism, because if you admit that it's that bad, then you have to start dealing with it. But if you can pretend as if it's just another thing, then, you know, it's much easier to just go on about your life. And none of us want our lives to change. You know, none of us want to have to do any of this. But we understand, I think, that the scale is so large and the consequences, you know, so unknown, that we can't help but, you know, feel anxiety and try to prepare. So it's fascinating. Again, I think it'll be a, you know, case study for psychologists everywhere, you know, just the difference in information accessibility, because my Uncle Joe is looking at something very different on Facebook than I'm looking at. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't have an Uncle Joe, but in my theoretical Uncle Joe is looking at something very different, just different access to information. So yeah, it's very strange, world we're living in.
And self-selected information. I find, like,
yeah, curated.
From the start of this, my next door neighbor went to a reopened Pennsylvania rally along with my crazy neighbor down the street, and they went and they were like, masks are stupid. This is not a big deal. And like, and then there are other people who I've seen comments from folks saying, like, we're never going to leave our house for the next 5 years. I'm like, well, maybe we're in between those two extremes.
There is a point, yeah, and I think as elected officials, it's a particularly important but difficult kind of bridge to gap, because you do have these people who are proud of their kind of disregard for any safety, and then you also have people who are, you know, maybe catastrophizing without, you know, information to back that up. So, and we have to, you know, try our best to, of course, be respectful and try to pull people in to the middle, most logical space. That's not easy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thinking about all the things you're saying and about how we started this conversation about acceptance. And you also brought up the comparison to 9/11, how it was a global issue. But, you know, when 9/11 happened, you were, like, in kindergarten. I was...
Yeah, literally.
I was in college and in New York. And I, you know, it was those things I still remember, of course, watching TV and everything happening. And everyone saw it. And one of the difference I see here is, If you don't have COVID and you're not in the hospital, you're not in healthcare, you don't see it like you saw when planes went into a building, and you saw that on repeat every minute.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, you talk about mental health. You also talk about, you know, acceptance of anybody in West Virginia or in Berkeley, you know, wherever, you know, just, it's, I think it's an issue that's everywhere, no matter what people think. Do you think that that lack of visual, in your life, makes it hard for people to accept everything that's going on?
For sure. You know, I've always believed that lived experience is the greatest teacher. You can't lecture somebody to enlightenment, you know, and I've experienced that myself. I wish, you know, for the longest time I thought, boy, there's got to be just a string of right words that will get somebody to understand. And maybe, but I haven't found them. and so what I have found is that lived experience is the greatest teacher. I can't tell you how many times I have walked up to a person or made friends with somebody who will later tell me I'd never met a trans person in my life, or you know, sometimes as well, I hated trans people, or I believed this terrible, you know, wild thing, or I had all these misconceptions about trans folks, and you are normal, quote unquote, painfully right. normal, some would say. And for me, I take those moments, and I kind of store them away in a mental file and say that, you know, I'm not doing anything special. I'm just walking around and living my life. But for some people, that lived experience for them, you know, is profound in changing their perception of what identity means or who trans people are. I wish it, you know, weren't that difficult, but yeah, you can't fix the world with an Instagram post, but you can by kind of just living your life and trying to be unapologetic about it.
Yeah, and, you know, as a straight white male, age 18 to 45, as Homer Simpson would say, you know, I've struggled over the past weeks with everything happening with the protests. I identify with, I empathize with everybody. You know, I agree Black Lives Matter, trans lives matter. But I also feel like I don't want to, you know, be performative. I don't want to steal the show. Like, I agree, but, like, is my Instagram post going to be the one that affects people? No, it shouldn't. It should be, you know, yesterday we had the administration on the anniversary of the Pulse shooting, you know, step back on trans and LGBT rights. And, you know, I'm an ally, but it shouldn't be just people like me speaking out, should it?
And you know, I think, you know, white people are particularly responsible for dethroning the people we helped elect, you know, especially like, you know, the folks in the Trump administration, the cabinet, all of that. The people who are, you know, complicit in their silence or omission from, you know, standing up for Black lives or trans lives or whatever that may be, or just the, you know, kind of preservation of our democracy at base. But so many people, I feel like the overwhelming feeling that we have right now is helplessness. Like we do not know how, I mean, we know how we got here, but we're not sure how we can get out and where our space is or where we are most valuable. And I know that's especially coming from a lot of my friends who are not people of color. You know, they are, you know, they're allies, but they're struggling to figure out the space they can occupy and also be allied with the movement and supportive. And I myself, you know, have those same feelings. My boyfriend is a man of color, and, you know, I'm like, what helps here? You know, what is important? And, you know, one of the most powerful things that, you know, people of color are saying right now is, it's not our job to teach you. Like, you have had, you know, hundreds of years to figure this out. You know, it's your turn to do this. So I think the most valuable thing we can do as white people now is to, you know, take responsibility for the world that exists right now and the kind of pressures that are on, you know, the African American community, especially from this administration. You know, I didn't vote for Trump, I don't support even a modicum of what's happening right now. But we have to understand that, you know, we need to do so much better, and we need to do so much more. And, you know, for me, I find that it's much easier to replace these people than to convince them to do the right thing. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, I felt my to run for office, and I hope that so many other people, you know, see that for themselves as well.
Yeah, and you know, one of the, you know, also the other big inspiring things about your story is that you said you're so young, and we talked about you know, the different perspectives both on COVID and even on 9/11. And you know, for years, there has been this long joke from people about, oh, young people are spending their money stupidly, or, oh, why don't you go put up an Instagram post, like you said. But people your age, people in their 20s and early 30s especially, have dealt with trauma after trauma, right? Like 9/11, you said, when you were in kindergarten, the stock market collapse, the election of Trump and all that inspired with that, the Iraq war, this, like, you... I think people need to stop badgering people about their age and just recognize, like, look, people who are young have dealt with trauma their entire lives.
Right. And the advent of, you know, the internet age, you know, I am a baby of the internet age. You know, I grew up and I cannot even remember a time without Google or without having, you know, complete access to what was happening around the world. And so, you know, that stimulus is also, I think, in so many ways overwhelming, because we're not just dealing with what happens in our towns or our states, but literally the world. And, you know, some people decide to shut off and, you know, play Candy Crush or whatever people play now, and they kind of go about their day. But I find that, you know, the more insightful folks, or at least the people who are paying more attention, they are in the streets. You know, we had an incredible rally, a Black Lives Matter rally here in the city of Wheeling a week or two ago, and the majority of people were high school students. They were young, younger than me, and I was like, "Damn, this is the future.
Yeah,
this looks good." And they're pissed off and they're angry, and hopefully they are preparing themselves to take control, because that is, you know, that's what we need.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with anyone 100% of the time, including myself. I've changed my mind. But I am excited to see that energy from young people that I hope translates to them participating in things. You know, I think about our, you know, you're not going to get rid of your police department, I assume, in Wheeling.
No, I don't think so.
And the only reason I would like to get rid of our police department in my town is because that would free up a lot of budget money, because we're in a depression right now. Like, that's the only...
Right, right.
Because our officers marched with protesters recently. But I would love to have the conversation with... I love to meet someone involved in politics who I've never met before. That's an exciting thing, right?
For sure.
So now you are going to have this government role. What tangible thing do you think that you can accomplish in Wheeling that you're hoping to look back on and say was a success?
There are quite a few tangible and intangible, you know, hopes that I have to move our community forward. In the tangible realm, we have an issue with homelessness in our community that is just, I think, unbelievable and unacceptable, and something that our current, you know, city government has done not enough to address. So I've worked with our homeless advocacy groups here in the city of Wheeling. We had a so when COVID first hit, the entire city shut down. Our libraries, our shelters, our soup kitchens, our everything. And, you know, for me, I just go home and sit on my computer all day. But for a person who is homeless and utilizes these services as their everyday kind of routine, there was no place to go. There was no place to shower, no place to use the restroom. There was no place to even have a moment to themselves. So we, here in the city of Wheeling, we had some homeless advocates create a personal hygiene station in our city. And I was so grateful to see that, and it was incredible. But that shouldn't have to happen. We should have those things set up already for our community. We shouldn't have to kind of create emergency resources to, you know, to care for our homeless community. That should be baseline. So, you know, for me, I really want to build a task force here in the city of Wheeling to tackle homelessness. And with my experience in mental health, I really think we can build something that is, you know, structurally sound and effective. So that's absolutely one. We have a huge issue also with vacant properties here in our city. We have a very old community, not in you know, physical age, but chronologically, you know, Wheeling is one of the oldest cities in the state of West Virginia, or also the former capital of the state. And some of our buildings, you know, show that. So we really do have to tackle those vacant properties and whether we can rehabilitate them or raise them. And, you know, one of the intangible issues that we experience here in the city is trust or lack thereof. And, you know, we had low voter turnout in this election, which, you know, disappointed me, but was not unique across the state. We had low voter turnout. And talking to folks, they said, oh, I believe in, you know, what you're talking about, and I think you do a good job, but, why bother? Why even go to the polls or fill out this absentee ballot? And that was consistent. People were just not inspired by anything. And when I feel like our democracy is most vulnerable, when people believe it doesn't work. And we have to do everything we can to reinforce the idea that, you know, votes matter. I won my election by 15 votes. Mm-hmm. That is a slim count margin. And I'm going to tell everybody I can that if you think your vote doesn't matter, like, hold on a minute. You know, go to your local election or your municipality and just think about who could have, you know, led your community versus who actually was elected. So those are a few issues that we're focused on here. And I think that although those are specific issues to Wheeling, they really do, I think, encompass what people are experiencing, you know, across our state.
Yeah, not just across your state. I talked with the mayor of Providence, Jorge Alorza, and he was talking about issues there, that they could be a template in Providence, Rhode Island for other places. And I think everyone, it's so easy to disregard homelessness. So if you can come up with something that is positive there, especially as you're raising your profile, then other cities that are also feeling the same thing can use that as a template and help others as well.
Exactly. We definitely don't have to reinvent the wheel here. We want to pull from as many, you know, communities as possible, because I feel like I watched a TED Talk not long ago about the work they're doing in Albuquerque and around homelessness, and I was like, my goodness, we don't have the budget of Albuquerque here in the city of Wheeling, I had imagined, but we can definitely bring some of those ideas here.
Yeah, and the issues there, I talked to someone from New Mexico. You obviously, Wheeling is a part of West Virginia, but West Virginia's got a big rural population and cultural issues. And in New Mexico, they have a big native population and lack of running water. So many of the issues in West Virginia are not all that different from New Mexico and other places.
Right.
And as an elected official, and now you can be part of YEO, the Young Elected Officials Network. I would recommend that.
Oh, yeah. I've never heard of it. Oh, my gosh.
You 100% should. I will, after this interview, I will tweet to a few people that you will be very happy to be connected with. But you can get a template that can work for other people and build on success together. You don't have to govern alone is a nice thing these days. So with all that in mind, the podcast is called You Should Run. You just went through a very invigorating time. You've been on. You had to postpone talking to little old Tony Heil because you were on MSNBC a couple hours ago. So why should other people, especially young people or people of different backgrounds, why should they run for office, especially now?
So for me, running for office was never in the plan. I was a community organizer, and I realized, you know, that I loved my work so much. I really loved the idea of being kind of scrappy, grassroots, on the ground, and I still feel that way, and I'm going to bring that to my you know, candidacy. But I realized during that time, you know, fighting for things, you know, like menstrual equity and LGBT rights and, you know, so many, and campaign finance reform, I realized that the biggest obstacle in our way, you know, wasn't anything theoretical. It was actually the elected officials that, you know, we were attempting to convince that our issue or our advocacy was the right way to go. And then I realized that, my goodness, if I really want to get these things done and see this thing through, I want to be in the room where that happens. And, you know, I feel like for a lot of younger people, and I've tried to convince, you know, people to run for office all the time before I started running, you know, every friend I had who I thought, you know, had a chance, I'd say, oh my gosh, you should run for office, but you would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But consistently the response is, oh my God, no, I couldn't do it. I don't want to be that. You know, it's the whole thing. It's corrupt, blah, blah, blah. And the sentiment, I understand the sentiment for sure, but you know, the reality is that we can protest and we can, you know, organize in a grassroots way, and that is effective, but we have to make sure that we are working on both sides here. We are hosting protests, but we're also running for office so that we can, you know, we don't have to work as hard. The hill is not as steep, right? If we have thoughtful, progressive people already in office. So, you know, for me, every person who wants to make a difference, you should want to be in the room where it happens, not just outside looking in. But you can run for office and make those decisions on your own. It's not easy, but it is well worth it.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you're going to be in that room. Finally, if people want to follow you, because a lot of people do right now, which is great, and they want to learn about all the things you were focused on, like mental health, homelessness, etc., what's the best way for them to follow you on social media?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter at Rosemary Ketchum, on Instagram as Rosemary Ketchum. Thank goodness nobody else has my name. So if you just look up Rosemary Ketchum or Ketchum for Council, you can find more information.
Great. Thank you so much, and best of luck. I hope that you make Wheeling the best it can be. It certainly deserves it.
Aw, thank you so much, Tony. I appreciate that.
And if you're listening, I hope you find other podcast episodes. There's over 75 of them here from all across the country. And if you have a recommendation, email me at tonyheil, tonyheil@gmail.com. And maybe you should run for office as well.